Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at WILL.UIUC.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois.
A sunny afternoon for...
We have a live show coming to you today from Campbell Hall, and we're going to be talking with the executive director of FairVote, perhaps the leading group working to transform American elections to achieve equal access to participation in a full spectrum of meaningful choices and majority rule. Our guest will be Rob Ritchie today in Media Matters, but first, before we go to Rob Ritchie, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. This was a watershed week for media reform, with three important bills being passed by key congressional committees and a raucous rally and hearing at the Federal Communications Commission. Tuesday, the Senate Commerce Committee advanced the bipartisan Local Community Radio Act, which could help bring hundreds of local low-power FM radio stations to cities and suburbs across the country. A companion bill awaits action in the House. The Senate Commerce Committee also approved the bipartisan Community Broadband Act. This bill would overturn state prohibitions against cities and towns providing their own high-speed internet services. It promises to bring faster, cheaper, and more reliable broadband services to local communities that now find themselves on the wrong side of the digital divide. And in the House, the Energy and Commerce Committee passed the Broadband Census of America Act. Currently, there are no reliable numbers to measure high-speed internet access and availability in the United States, which has been falling behind the rest of the world. The bill would require both the National Telecommunications and Information Administration and the FCC to collect more and more accurate information. And to punctuate the week, on Halloween, hundreds of citizens rallied at FCC headquarters to send a message to big media and FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. The agency held its final localism hearing with only a few days' advance notice. Yet civil rights and labor leaders, consumer and media reform advocates, and a team of cheerleaders showed up to speak out against more media consolidation. Media Minutes will have more highlights from the event next week.
Media consolidation has had a detrimental effect on children's television programming, according to new research by Children Now, a California-based advocacy group focused on making children a top priority in public policy. Quality educational programming is beneficial to children, says Christy Globke, director of the group's Children in the Media program and author of the study Big Media, Little Kids 2. Globke says programs like Sesame Street can help young kids prepare for kindergarten, and the effects can last through high school.
For those students who may be more at a disadvantage, may not have access to quality preschool or access to a lot of books in their homes, it actually helps level the playing field for them.
The Big Media Little Kids 2 study looked at the effect of duopolies, those markets where one company owns two stations. They chose eight various sized markets, such as Chicago and El Paso, and compared programming in 2 years, 1998, before the duopolies were permitted, and 2006.
If you look at the hours of children's programming that was offered on the stations, duopolies decreased their programs over that time period, but the hours of programming by four times more than non-duopoly stations. And if you look at the number of series that were offered to kids, they decreased their programming by five times more than non-duopoly stations. They were big decreases.
Broadcasters are reluctant to air children's programming because it isn't as lucrative as adult or sports programming. In 1996, Congress and the FCC required them to air at least 3 hours of children's educational programming per week. But broadcasters say that if kids are watching programming on cable, why should they have to air programming on broadcast channels? Globke has a couple of answers for them.
About 15% of kids don't have access to cable or satellite television. All they have is access to commercial broadcast television. The other part of it is that broadcasters are using a valuable public resource, the public airwaves, for free. They aren't paying for it. And because they use it for free, they need to give something back to the communities that they serve. And one of the very few ways that have been identified that require them to serve the public is children's educational programming.
Globke hopes the study will help policymakers understand the need for quality children's programming on broadcast stations. She says children's media advocacy isn't just about keeping bad media away from kids. It's really about helping to create good media that can benefit children. For more information about the study, go to childrennow.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to take up a topic we've covered periodically in Media Matters. We normally deal explicitly with media issues or work with journalists who deal with media or just journalists themselves and the work they're working on. Today we're going to turn to the subject of electoral reform, of voting reform, which is a very closely related issue to media and media reform and the institutional basis of self-government. So it's a common theme for us here, and it's a theme that's been very popular with listeners, and we've had lots of requests to continue in this vein. So today is our guest on Media Matters. We're very fortunate to have the executive director of Fair Vote, a nonprofit organization which has been perhaps the leader or one of the leaders in the movement to transform American elections. His name is Rob Ritchie. Rob Ritchie is the co-author of Every Vote Equal and also the co-author of Whose Votes Counts. His writings have appeared in newspapers across the country. He's been on all the major news media to discuss these issues. He is truly one of the great experts of our times. Rob Ritchie, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you, Bob. That's lavish praise, but right back at you, and I'm very pleased to be on the show.
Well, let's start in. There's so much to cover, because when I go through the body of your work, you really cover the waterfront of all the main electoral and voting rights issues, and there's a lot of turf here I want to cover today. The first one, though, I'd really like to get at is we have presidential elections coming up, and probably before some people blink, we'll have two nominees for the Republican and Democratic Party as soon as the end of January, fully 9 or 10 months before Election Day. We'll already know the two nominees of the Republican and Democratic Party. Can you just explain to the layperson who's sort of not a political junkie, who's just sort of not really following the presidential election very closely yet, what on earth is going on?
Well, it's a classic example of how our system isn't necessarily developing in a rational way. You know, here we pride ourselves on being a leader in democracy, and there are some elements of our democracy that work well. But as you know, in media, there's a lot to do, and certainly in voting, there is. And we have this very fractured state by state way of dealing with a lot of issues. Like, there are more than 13,000 jurisdictions that make decisions about the voting process that affect presidential races, and they can make, you know, different ones about ballot design and so on. In this case, you have different states all wanting to jockey among themselves to be close to the front of the cycle for who gets to vote first in the presidential primary season. In Iowa and New Hampshire have kind of proclaimed that it could be in the Constitution that they have to go first. Of course, it's not. But
yeah, I mean, that just developed in the last 30 or 40 years, didn't it?
Exactly. It's just they just kind of asserted their right to be there. New Hampshire did it first, and they had some exciting primaries like 1968 when McCarthy took on Johnson, and they sort of got a certain kind of allure, and then Iowa in 1976 with Carter. But there's no reason why they should get to go first every year, and other states resent that. And we saw in 2004 the kind of rush to embrace John Kerry after he won in Iowa in an upset and then carried that momentum into New Hampshire and then just kind of swept through. And then almost, you know, most of the remaining states had pretty meaningless primaries. And so what the parties have set up is that Iowa and New Hampshire are supposed to be able to go first under their party rules, but they set up the first Tuesday in February as kind of a free chance for everyone else. And a whole bunch of states moved up to their primary to February 5th. And then some states didn't stop there. They decided to kind of challenge the party rules, and Florida and Michigan and a couple other states have moved their votes into January. Iowa and New Hampshire feel they always should go first, so they've moved their votes up. And Iowa now says they're going to be on January 4th. In New Hampshire, the Secretary of State has the power under their statute to actually declare a primary in early December, or to tell us when the primary is going to be. And it may well be in December. So we actually may vote this year for next year's presidential nominee.
I mean, this is almost being reduced to the absurd. Why not have the primary this year for 2012?
some people are thinking about it. In fact, one of my colleagues was saying you really could test New Hampshire by some state setting a caucus for, you know, November 15th of 08. For 2012, and New Hampshire tries to schedule on election day or something. But and it's something we really can change. The parties have the power to change it, and there's some really good momentum within the parties to move to a more rational system. Congress is exploring potential changes, but it gets into some tricky ground where can Congress actually regulate party activity? And then, of course, states, when there are primaries and public, you know, publicly financed in the sense of running the elections, they have to kind of go along with the party rule, too, though a state like Iowa has a caucus, which is actually not paid for by the state. So there's sort of these different elements to how the law work out. But it is something we really can make better, and there's a range of really interesting proposals.
Some of the best ones, Rob Ritchie?
Well, I'd urge people to check them out at fixtheprimaries.com. It's a project we have, and it lays them out pretty well, fixtheprimaries.com. There's different ones. The one that we like best is called the American Plan, and it keeps the idea of a series of primaries and caucuses happening in a progress, you know, sort of a gradually larger number of states order. So there would be states with a total number of congressional districts of 8 voting first, but it would be done by lottery. So it wouldn't always be Iowa and New Hampshire. It could be one state with 8 congressional districts or 8 states with 1 each. And that would change every time. And then there would be a 2-week break, and then there would be states with a total of 16 congressional districts, and then 2-week break, and then those with 24. It would allow candidates to emerge from the pack to be able to focus their attention on the media in some ways early on, really trying to get those editorial endorsements in this, you know, the states that are first. But it would change every cycle, and there would be this kind of progressive flow in the size. And so, let's say you stumble early on, you scream in an inopportune way on the night of the election or something like Howard Dean did, you still can recover because the biggest states and the most delegates wouldn't be allocated until the end. We could even see a situation like this next year. Let's say the candidates are all kind of stumbling and people really wanted an Al Gore or a Newt Gingrich or whomever to jump in. They still could, you know, because there'd be enough votes coming up later and enough delegates that, you know, people could turn to someone else, which I think is interesting. That's one proposal. There's a variation of that the Republicans almost passed in 2000. It's kind of one of the side stories of 2000. We would be having a whole different conversation right now if on the floor of the Republican convention in 2000 they had finished the process that they nearly did, which was to establish what they call the Delaware Plan, which would have Delaware and other small states always voting first. So it would be the 13 smallest states always voting first. Mm-hmm. Then a one-month break, so a big break. And then the next biggest 13 states, then another one-month break, and so on until the final states vote, which has some interesting merits as well. I'd be pretty sympathetic to that. There's a new proposal put forward by Jonathan Soros in the New York Times that I thought was quite interesting just last week. His idea is to say, well, the only way to really have every vote equal is to have a national primary. But if you just sort of had a national primary where everyone voted the same day, it would just be, you know, a huge money issue and no chance for real deliberation. But his thought was you could start the voting in early January and finish it in late June and have early voting and vote by mail and then release ballot results periodically, maybe every week or every 2 weeks or something, so you could say, well, here's where the horse race is, but there'd be a space between those. And it'd be a really interesting sort of gaming of what it might look like, because a lot of people don't want to just vote for necessarily the person they like the most. They want to vote for the one they think is going to be the winner. And you won't really know it at the point. So the people who are likely to vote early are the ones who really are committed to their candidates. And you can't necessarily buy that commitment with, you know, spending lots of money and so on. It's got to be earned in a sense. And you could have, you know, a candidate could say, well, I'm going to really focus in one state, and I'll report how I do. You know, we'll all see how I do after 2-3 weeks, and you can really see how that candidate does when people really get to know them. It's kind of an interesting idea. It's an area where we find people have come up with a lot of different ideas, and I think any number of them are better than what we have now.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of Fair Vote, one of the leading activists and experts on election laws, Voting Rights Acts. We're going to be talking with him the full hour about the American electoral system and possible reforms to improve it, and Lord knows it does need improvement. We've just been talking about the primary system. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Rob Ritchie, I want to turn now to the question of the Electoral College, which I know you've also worked on. I recall, and I might be mistaken here, but I recall, if I'm not mistaken, in 2000, just before the presidential election in 2000, literally within days, much of the conventional wisdom was there was an opportunity that we would have a situation where Al Gore would win the election, but George W. Bush would win the popular vote, because Bush was, at that point, just a couple of days going before the election, was ahead in most of the polls by a point or two. Yet they thought the way the states could fall, he could lose states like Florida and possibly even Ohio closely. So you'd have a situation, we'd have a president elected in the Electoral College, but not winning the popular vote. And I recall there was some talk behind the scenes of doing a big publicity campaign about how unfair this was, that the person who got the most votes didn't win. Well, then what happened is the exact opposite happened. Al Gore won the the popular vote dramatically by 500,000 votes. And then after all the machinations, apparently lost Florida to the satisfaction of the U.S. Supreme Court and did not become president. And there was no real discussion beyond that. That sort of discussion fell from view. This Electoral College thing is very baffling for my students who really don't understand why we have it or what its purpose is. Could you explain, like, what is the origins of it and what role does it play today, and does it play, do we need it anymore?
Yeah, well, I'll start at the end. I'll just say, no, we don't need it, and we better change it soon. And actually, Illinois may be the second state to join my state of Maryland in this new movement to establish a national popular vote, which we'll get to in a moment. Mm-hmm. But the origins of the Electoral College are founded on the idea that when we started our democracy, representative system, there was a very wide variation on who had the franchise in different states. And, you know, some states had relatively good laws, like Pennsylvania. Some states, like Massachusetts, had extremely restrictive laws. You had to have, you know, owned property for a certain amount of time. And,
wasn't Pennsylvania just about the only state with universal adult white male suffrage?
Right. They actually then went backwards eventually, but then, you know, eventually states got better and better. But it took a lot of time. And, of course, women didn't have the right to vote, and African Americans, and, you know, there was a lot of suffrage questions. But the debate was, if every vote was pooled into a national popular vote, those suffrage issues would really matter and affect states' power. That was tricky. The simple act of how to count votes nationally was seen as complicated. Of course, people at that time tended to vote in person. You know, we didn't have secret ballots until the late 1800s, you know, so people used to not have a state-financed ballot. You know, you would actually come with your own ballot, you know, written down. Usually the party gave you what they wanted you to do, and you just sort of handed it in. So the way we voted was quite different. And there was the whole issue of slavery and the fact that when you do it by the Electoral College system, it's based on population and the number of congressional districts you have. And the fact that slaves were counted as 3/5 of a person for the purposes of congressional apportionment, you know, gave the southern states this extra edge with people who would never vote, but they would be counted toward their kind of political power. And James Madison was a big backer, well, not a big backer, but he did support the idea of a national vote for president, but he said, you know, these are political and complicated obstacles that we just can't get through as we're trying to get a new constitution. And then some others just really were fearful of people voting for president. They supported people voting for the House of Representatives, but we didn't directly elect the U.S. Senate until the 20th century, and they thought this indirect vote for president would actually be a pretty meaningful vote at the Electoral College. They conceived of these folks being elected by states and then actually deliberating and picking a person for president who would be their own thoughts for, you know, their own way of thinking, not necessarily instructed by the voters. So their conception of how it all might work was very different from what actually worked. But we sort of set up the system, and each state has the number of electors equal to the number of members of Congress, and each state has total plenary power over how to allocate those electors under what rule. And early on, they actually mostly didn't have elections. The state legislature would appoint the electors. Sometimes they did it by congressional district. Sometimes, you know, there's a big variation. Ultimately, by the 1830s, they settled on almost every state on giving all of your electoral votes to whoever wins the statewide vote.
Winner take all.
Winner take all. And that was founded on the idea that, you know, you can help your side the most that way. And if you happen to be a close state, you get more attention, because if the candidate wins, gets everything, and the candidate loses, gets nothing. So it's a good state to, as a candidate, to go spend some time in, or in that era, for at least the parties to kind of work hard in that era. As often happens, we just sort of stuck with it, and we just stopped talking about the fact that we can change it. And under the Constitution, it's states that have the power to change the system. And so even though right now we're at a position where when your state isn't close, and most states are not close, in fact, Illinois was the largest population state in 2004, that in the last 6 weeks of the campaign had nary a single visit by one of the major party presidential or vice presidential campaigns, and not a single campaign ad by any force, whether the campaign or an independent ad, you know, because it was seen as a safe Democratic state. And once you're in that territory, you're completely ignored. And that's about 35 states right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we can change this. People have said, well, you know, we have to change the Constitution to do a direct election of president, and that was all the talk after 2000. But in fact, that's not what you have to do. It's you know, states are empowered to be creative and do what's best for presidential elections. And the realization that came forward with a guy named John Kozo came up with this plan, and it's a great concept. It's that states have two interesting constitutional powers. They have that power over electors, which we talked about, and they can do, sort of states can do whatever they want. And then two, they can enter into formal binding contracts with other states called interstate compacts. And there's a number of them, like the Port Authority between New York and New Jersey and the Colorado River one, and there's about 200 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that states would enter into a binding contract, a compact, to give all of their electoral votes in their state to the candidate who wins not the popular vote in their state, but the popular vote in all 50 states and D.C., the national popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
And to do so once it was decisive, once the number of states that have entered into this agreement together have a majority of the Electoral College, because at that point, they as a bloc will guarantee that the national popular vote winner wins. And our state of Maryland has sort of initiated this compact. Illinois has passed both houses. It's passed in a number of other chambers in other states, and I think we'll have it by 2012. It's a really exciting effort.
And if listeners who are interested, Rob Ritchie, in getting, we have lots of listeners not only in Illinois, but thanks to podcasting, the internet across the country. What should they do if they want to sort of let their legislators know and get on?
Well, it's a great issue to get involved in. It's because your state is debating this. That's pretty much a guarantee. There were 47 states had bills in this year, and I think the final three will be for sure done in the next cycle. And nationalpopularvote.com is the home for the National Popular Vote campaign, and it's a really exciting effort. And Illinois, as I said, is poised to be on the forefront. It's the legislature's in this kind of weird place right now where they need to just get to an agreement over some minor difference between the two bills, and then it can go to the governor, and they keep not having quorum because of these battles they're having over something I'm not quite sure of. But anyway, they keep almost voting on it, but they haven't. But the expectation is that they will.
Well, Rob, let me ask you this. Who could oppose this? I mean, where is the opposition coming from? Who are the people who want to stick with the status quo?
Well, this is a good media question, because like David Broder, there's a bunch of sort of entrenched media pundit types who think they believe the Electoral College is good for us, and they have a lot of argument. I mean, the foundation of their argument really is, well, we've been around for 220 years. It's got to be for something, and maybe it's the Electoral College. You know, so it's kind of the same argument that could have been used in 1915 against women's suffrage or having a direct election of Senate. It's like, well, we've survived so far. It must be the system's working for us. But they will then go on to further say a lot of things that are pretty easily dismissed. Like one thing is, well, the Electoral College really helps small states, and, you know, without it, the candidates would never go to a small state ever again. And, of course, one, we still have the presidential primary system we can set up, so that, of course, can have one where small states play a key role. But also, when every vote is equal, every voter is equal, and whether I live in a small state or a big state or whatever, my act of voting and my act of talking to my neighbors is meaningful. And get-out-the-vote operations aren't really about the presidential candidates themselves, you know, knocking on your door. It's about the whole enterprise of people caring about a campaign and getting involved, and that'll happen everywhere. But as it is right now, those political acts are meaningless in about 35 states, and everyone knows that. And one of the key evidences of that was George Bush in 2004, you know, the richest campaign in history. They, in the last 30 months of the campaign, they didn't poll a single person, not one person, who lived outside of the 17 battleground states. They never did, or sort of the initial scoping of 17 potential battlegrounds. And they didn't do a national poll, because that would have been wasting money. And they didn't poll in Illinois and bunches of other states, because those people's views don't matter. You know, it's just really zeroing in. So some of the opposition will come from people who think that they get something out of the current system. We also are encountering, I think, sort of knee-jerk Republican opposition that comes from the 2000 election, and it's like, well, George Bush won, and Al Gore would have won with your system, so it's got to be bad. I think once Bush leaves, that some of that opposition will melt away more. There has been some Republican support in the Illinois legislature, but it's been tough. It's been tougher than I would have liked to see. It used to be much more of a bipartisan issue. I think it can be again, but for the moment, you tend to see some Republican recalcitrance.
What about Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, who's made a big deal out of his interest in electoral reform? Where does he stand on this issue?
He vetoed it. In fact, his state could have been first, and he vetoed it on very, I think, weak grounds. Something about caring about small states, and of course, as governor of California, he's got to care about the small states, I guess. And
we might run for president of Austria.
You never know. And also, some people get stuck on this idea that presidential elections are about electing electors, and they're really about electing presidents. But he said, I don't want the California's electoral votes to go to someone who didn't win in California. But of course, the whole concept of a national popular vote is you want the winner of the national popular vote to be president. So that means that, you know, sometimes California is going to vote differently than the country, but that's okay. We as a country and states have made an agreement that we want the national popular vote candidate to win.
You would think that the TV companies that own television stations in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, and San Diego would smash them over the head and say, do you realize we're not getting any presidential TV ads?
That's a good point. No, we should reach out to them, because it's going to go before him again. It has the votes in the legislature. They just don't want to send it up to him.
I mean, that's literally probably $500 million a year in revenues that they're losing.
Yeah, back after the 2000 election, Ted Turner, CNN, who was at that point still head of CNN, he came out for direct election of president and runoff elections, the candidate needing a majority of the vote. And that's something we support, the idea of an instant runoff or a majority requirement that kind of handles the third-party, quote-unquote, spoiler issue. But then someone pointed out, of course he'd love that, because CNN would get ads, you know, for a runoff election, too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, I think you're onto something that maybe kind of appealing to that media interest could.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Rob Ritchie, the executive director of Fair Vote, one of the leading groups that battles to transform American elections to achieve equal access to participation, a full spectrum of meaningful choices, and majority rule for fair representation and a voice for all. You can learn more about Fair Vote at www.fairvote.org. Our phone number here at Media Matters, this is a live show, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, as always, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller who's been waiting patiently. Let's go now to line 4, Buckley, Illinois. You're on the air with Rob Ritchie.
Hello. Sorry to bounce back to an earlier topic of the primaries, but I find them boring and very annoying because I'm neither a Democrat nor a Republican. Sometimes when the president, sitting president, is running, then people cross parties in order to vote for the other party. I suggest that the independents, who are by far a large majority in some states, should have a primary in all states on a certain date. On this date, they would have the top two people automatically put on the national ballot. And by these Republicans and Democrats, if they want to choose their own candidates, fine. But at least the rest of us will have a candidate on the ballot that we like. There's about 20 people running in Republican-Democrat Party this year. Most of them are useless, and a few of them are dangerous. So we need to have a real choice.
Well, thank you very much. Rob, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm very sympathetic to the caller's point about not feeling that politics should be tied to whoever the Democrats and Republicans nominate, that you know, free choice and free debate and open elections shouldn't do that. And in fact, we're a real outlier in international terms in having that really narrow kind of choice in our general elections. There's one problem that relates to what he says is we have these terrible ballot access laws for third parties and independents, and it's, you know, done state by state. And in fact, there's a very interesting effort right now going on in Oklahoma to try to trying to qualify as a ballot measure to change their ballot access, because it's almost impossible for a candidate to get on the ballot in Oklahoma. But it basically varies state by state, and that's part of this kind of weird system, you know, voting for president, but you know, you have to deal with it state by state.
And if I can interrupt, I mean, this is where you really get some corruption, because the two parties write the laws about whether a third party can get on the ballot, sort of like Coke and Pepsi get to write the laws about whether someone can start a new cola.
Right, exactly. And it, I mean, even defenders of the two-party system, when they sort of think it through, should realize that it's not defenders of the Democrats and Republicans. It's defenders of maybe ultimately having two main choices. But we should have a system that allows the emergence of a new party to displace a major party, or however you might see it. You know, it just is not the way a good kind of quote-unquote market system works, to suppress potential sort of competition and different ideas. There's also the whole issue of debate access, which is a media issue to some degree as well in general elections, and all the debates that go over keeping out sort of legitimate candidates from having a place in the debates, even when they will put such candidates in the primary debates. They won't put them in the general election debates because, you know, they challenge the two-party system. So I think we need a national ballot access law. I think the caller's concept would go well with a national ballot access law. It would be very difficult to enforce. You know, we could have an interstate compact, perhaps, to do the kind of a similar thing for ballot access. I do think it goes hand in hand with something that I dearly love and support, which is the idea of instant runoff voting.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go. We've talked about instant runoff voting on this program in the past on a couple of occasions, and like you, I think it is really a brilliant plan. And why don't you explain it, if you would, and explain how it works, and then what its status is in the United States today.
Sure, and it speaks directly to this idea of independents and third parties, you know, joining our general elections, but also just having more than two choices in the primaries as well. Whenever you have more than two choices and only one person wins, you know, the math of it begins to be that someone can win with, you know, less than half the votes, because you can split 35, 34, 32 or something like that. And then whenever you're in that situation, that third candidate, you know, might be drawing a lot of support from the candidate who finishes second, and together their votes are a majority, but separately they lose. And that's sort of the whole Ralph Nader debate in 2000 or Ross Perot debate in his presidential campaigns, that they're spoilers. They're like, you know, they're ruining the election for everybody by presenting themselves as an option. And an instant runoff system is founded on the idea, well, if you're only going to elect one person, you should require that person to win a majority of the vote, at least half support plus one, and you can allow people to indicate their choices in such a way that you can determine the majority winner. So you would, instead of just voting X for one, you would rank them 1, 2, 3. So you say, well, here's my first choice, but in the event that my first choice is not a strong candidate and is going to lose because they're not in the top 2 or 3 candidates, my ballot, I want it to go to this second choice, and that's your number 2 ranking. And, you know, then maybe a 3rd ranking. And just doing that alone allows you to get a majority winner and to kind of much more freely be able to consider the candidates and vote your heart and vote the way you really want to. Like in the primaries, a lot of people like a Dennis Kucinich right now, but they're thinking, well, he's not going to win, and I do like John Edwards better than Hillary Clinton or, you know, whatever it might be, Barack Obama, of course. You know, and so they end up not voting for whom they want to. And an instant runoff system kind of liberates you to vote the way you want. It's been used in a number of other countries for some very big elections, but it's also gotten rapid growth in the United States, and in fact, maybe on the ballot in Urbana in the next few months. There was a signature gathering campaign that has turned their signatures in. I haven't heard if they qualified, but they may be the next one up. There's 4 cities voting on Tuesday on it, including Sarasota, Florida, and Aspen, Colorado, and Clallam County, Washington, up in rural Washington, and Pierce County, Washington's having a kind of a follow-up vote. It's passed in Minneapolis, Oakland, San Francisco, used for a couple of new North Carolina cities this month, and it's working well where it's used. We often have to encounter resistance from the way we run elections on kind of outdated voting equipment or kind of inefficient voting equipment, and the vendor, these sort of private vendors that overcharge for any kind of change you need to do for the public interest. So there's sort of a transition time that can be frustrating, but at the same time, it's working well, and it really just makes sense to people. It's a common sense system.
Well, I mean, and just to add to it, because I've studied it quite a bit myself, the advantage of the system, as I understand it, is that if you want to start a third party to push an issue you think it's not getting attention, you can do so and sort of force the other politicians to pay attention to it by generating the support for it. So even if you're at heart a Republican or Democrat, you think they're basically great parties, this only can strengthen a party to make it more responsive to the concerns of voters.
Exactly, because right now they can take people for granted who are sort of seen as they'll never vote for the other major party. So, you know, the only leverage you have as a voter if you're not going to vote for the other major party is sitting out and abstaining, and that's kind of a pathetic kind of way to to show your power. And it's better to be able to, like, vote for something you really want. And it's a way to hold people accountable. You know,
I'm reminded of the great line by the comedian George Carlin, who said, "In America, you get lots of choice for all sorts of things as long as they're trivial. But you don't get them in things that count, like political elections."
Yeah, right. Which is kind of interesting. This is why, you know, this is in some ways my favorite time in American political politics. In the primary season, when the parties show their fuller tent more publicly, mm-hmm. you do have Dennis Kucinich there, and you do have Ron Paul, and you have some of the differences, yeah. Gary Bauer in past cycles, or Steve Forbes, or Alan Keyes, or, you know, just sort of different things being said. But then they kind of quietly get dealt with by, you know, by the early primaries, and then we kind of can narrow the field to kind of quote-unquote legitimate candidates, and of course, we lose a lot in the dialogue.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. My guest today, Rob Ritchie, Executive Director of FairVote. We're talking about election laws, voting rights, so feel free to call in and join us if you'd like at 333-9455 or the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. As I said, let's go to the phone line right now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes. I would like you to comment on the other side of the coin, which is really the most important. It doesn't matter who votes, but who counts the votes. Can you talk about that issue? And I thank you, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And Rob, before you answered, I should tell you that I think about 5 weeks ago on the show, we had as our guest Mark Crispin Miller, who's done a lot of work on the vote counting issue in Ohio and nationally, and the problems with counting the votes in elections. And, you know, this is work that's been done not only by Mark Miller, but by Harvey Wasserman and by Bobby Kennedy Jr. And I'm sure you're familiar with it. What's your take on that?
Well, early on in the show, we sort of talked about this incredible kind of weird, decentralized, underfunded sort of democracy on the cheap kind of way we do things, you know, with all these kind of erratic standards. And then as part of that, we have the very few number of voting equipment vendors that we that sort of jurisdictions can turn to. It's really hard to make money in that industry, and it's a for-profit business. So if you can't make money, then you're not going to be there. And but you need to get federal certification and then certification in each state. And they had to break up a monopoly about 10 years ago of a voting equipment monopoly. It's actually one of the times the federal government stepped in and said, you know, this needs to be broken up. And the two biggest companies are still run by two brothers, you know, so those are the companies that were, quote unquote, broken up. So they're, at Thanksgiving at least, they're you know, back together again. and they all, you know, it's sort of this democracy on the cheap kind of concept, which is I don't think they produce very good products, and we don't really know because they are for profit, so they have proprietary software, and we certainly get lots of indications of serious problems, and yet the way we're dealing with it, I think, is still kind of in a very simple notion. We're sort of like trying to regulate them better, even requiring paper trails, which is sort of a no-brainer when you don't know for sure whether what they're doing in the kind of electronic machines. But even then, you're still left with these companies with proprietary software and things. I think we need to kind of reorient the whole way we approach the problem and say, look, we can, you know, send landers to Mars and pick up rocks and bring them back and study them. And, you know, like, we can do this. And we can actually, you know, get something that we can trust and have a publicly own process with open source software and paper ballots that we can see, and then the flexibility to handle some new idea like instant runoff voting. But right now, we're not even really close to that debate right now. So there's a huge amount of distrust and a lot of inefficiency and problems, and, you know, the potential of outright corruption and stealing, which some people are saying is happening. And it's, you know, there's a lot of debate on both sides. I'm not convinced that, you know, some of the big elections have been stolen. But the very fact that we could think they might be is absurd and, you know, something that we need to take on.
Our guest, Rob Ritchie, I'll go back to the phone lines in a second, but there's so much I want to talk about with you, Rob. I could have you on for one of those Jerry Lewis marathons.
There we go.
Because, I mean, we've really barely scraped the surface of some of the key issues that are involved here. And before we go any further, let me just ask you about media coverage of these sorts of issues. What's been your experience with how good a job the news media are doing in conveying the range and complexity and options available to the American people in understanding our electoral system and voting rights?
Well, I think certainly the people who feel that, you know, Robert Kennedy and others who are really charging, you know, outright malfeasance and Ohio and things have certainly presented enough evidence that it should be written about a lot more seriously than it is, and yet it really sort of dances on the outliers of our media, and that's sort of an example of sort of groupthink and difficulties in having challenging notions kind of debated as seriously as they should be. We've had some of our ideas get pretty favorable media, so I'm not going to complain about some of the media that we've gotten. They certainly, though, don't, you know, they don't lead usually with it, right? Mm-hmm. So we can be talking about instant runoff voting, and they don't really write about it, and, you know, until something like we win in San Francisco, and then it actually did get some good press.
You know, at the national level, oftentimes political reporters will basically only cover an issue seriously if candidates are making a big deal out of it.
Right, right. They don't set the agenda.
Are there any candidates now for either Republican or Democratic president, for example, who've done anything to elevate these issues in their campaigns?
I'm hoping the issue of the Electoral College and presidential elections gets debated more. I think it's sort of dicey for the candidates because they have to run in the current system. So you actually had Bill Richardson saying in Iowa that God wants Iowa to vote first. He really said that. And
God also wants Iowans to vote for him, apparently.
Right, exactly. So he doesn't want to, you know, like Howard Dean actually had said, you know, in his sort of before he was running for president days that Iowa shouldn't always go first, and that I quoted back to him. And so it's hard for them to talk about presidential primary reform. It's hard for them to talk about the Electoral College to some degree because they have to win in it in November. And then something like instant runoff voting, it's interesting. John McCain actually did a terrific statement on instant runoff voting when it was on the ballot in Alaska a few years ago. But it's not sort of the issue that I suspect he sees as a winning issue in the Republican Party right now. It was more when he was flirting, I think, with independence and the possibility of the value of more choice in politics. But it really is a very good statement. Barack Obama was the lead sponsor of an instant runoff voting bill in the Illinois state legislature. Mm-hmm. So he certainly understands it. He knows about cumulative voting and proportional representation, which we haven't talked about yet either from his lawyer days, and the value of those ideas, but he hasn't been particularly daring in talking about them. But there is some familiarity. Oh, Dennis Kucinich does, and I don't want to do what the media does, which is not pretend he's sort of running, but he's great on this stuff. He actually has a very clear statement about both instant runoff voting and proportional representation, and spoke at an event we did on the idea of the power of a constitutional right to vote, and is very strong on these issues.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Today, our guest on Media Matters is Rob Ritchie, the executive director of Fair Vote. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about if your guest has an opinion on giving people who've been in prison, who get out and they've served their time and they're working. And I heard stories about African-Americans in Georgia and Florida who had, you know, had been in jail but came out, and they were deliberately being kept from the polls. And sometimes it was a case of, you know, identification, long lines, poor machines, whatever. But does your guest have any comments on that?
Well, there's a couple key points that the caller raises there. One is the idea that some states, or the reality that some states will not allow people to vote sometimes for the rest of their lives if they ever have a felony conviction, whether they were incarcerated or not, and whether you had it in that state or not. Like, you can move into a state that has one of these laws, not know that you're in a state that does this, and, you know, you had some felony conviction when you were 20 and you're now 47 or something, and you vote, and you're suddenly a criminal again, you know, for the act of voting. There are about 5 million Americans, somewhere between 4 and 5 million American citizens who are adults who have been disenfranchised by state laws based on felony convictions.
Rob, if I can interrupt you on just that very point, how does this compare to countries like France or Germany? Is this standard around the world that you have such an enormous number of people who are disenfranchised?
No, it might be true of Iran and a couple other places, but it's very rare. And actually in Canada, you can be incarcerated and vote. Realizing that you're a citizen, and, you know, if we think of the right to vote as a pillar of a representative democracy system, like the right to free speech, we do have a right to free speech in the Constitution. We don't have a right to vote in the Constitution, which is why states can do this. That there are limits to how far states can go in disenfranchising people, but we have millions of Americans who can't vote, but they could vote if they lived in a different state. A whole other group of people is citizens who live in the territories, and there's a whole story behind that, but basically they don't live in states, but they're citizens, and if they move to the United States and establish residency in a few weeks, which they will, they can vote in that state, but they can't vote sort of where they are. And same with felony convictions. We're a real outlier. And we're a real outlier for not having a right to vote in the Constitution, too. That's much more the norm. And that doesn't always clear up all your voting problems, but it gives you strict scrutiny to protect the franchise. The other point the caller raised was the use of photo IDs. There's a whole debate about, you know, sort of whether we need to do more to create voter access to make it more likely that people vote who are trying to vote, or to have, you know, secure elections that are fraud-free that might hurt voter access. And, of course, there's a lot more people who don't vote because of voter access problems, like six-hour-long lines in Cleveland or what have you, than, you know, trying to cheat and vote twice in a day or something. The voter fraud accusations are almost always don't hold up to any kind of scrutiny when people look at them. But we see a debate where they're kind of given equal standing. And so this issue of photo IDs, which people say, well, that just makes sense. Sure, you have to show a photo ID when you vote. Whereas a lot of people actually don't have a driver's license. They don't drive, and it's not easy and cheap for them to get a photo ID. And in states that are putting in these requirements, that can sometimes disenfranchise quite a number of people.
Our guest today, Rob Ritchie. Let's go back to the phone lines to line 3, Champaign County. You're on the air with Rob Ritchie of Fair Vote.
Good afternoon. I wanted to go back to the money, and you made the counter example that San Francisco, L.A., which are huge markets, are missing out on all of this larcenous campaign donation spending. But isn't it true, and you must have a chart of this somewhere, Bob, that the network-owned stations have a huge percentage of the market. So if it is indeed the case, then NBC is making its money, you know, doesn't have to depend on its affiliate in the great state of California, where a lot of money could be made. So it seems that that's the other part of the story.
You know, that's interesting to interrupt you on that, just because off the top of my head, I think almost all the main network-owned stations, the ones that are big profit winners, are, interestingly enough, in states that are not swing states. You know, they're in Illinois, New York, California, states where they aren't getting a lot of necessarily presidential TV ads, but that's just an aside.
Really?
But they own a lot of stations in smaller states, too. I think they're missing a gravy train if there were... if you didn't have the Electoral College system, those stations would suddenly get a lot of ads they aren't getting. So I think this is not that I would encourage more political advertising on television, as I'm not a big fan of that area whatsoever.
But the other part of that is that if all votes are equally rated, then there is the chance, and maybe this is the calculation they're making, that there'll be a lot of money spent on different means of reaching people in smaller states that have never been fought over before, in areas where there's no difference. So it would diversify the spending quite a bit, it seems to me, and they might lose some of their cash cow. The only other thing I wanted to say as an aside is that popular recall, as they have in the Venezuelan constitution, would be a good long-term addition to our party politic, it seems to me. Then we wouldn't have to be frustrated by pusillanimous Democrats who won't consider impeachment. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much. Rob, I want to just move on to get to a couple of the other issues that I've got on my list I want to talk about with you. One of them is something we haven't discussed yet, but which definitely, I think, affects the quality of our electoral system, which is gerrymandering. The Economist, the British business publication, has written that in most democracies, voters select their representatives. In the United States, representatives select their voters. And we're in a situation in Illinois, like most states, where the vast majority of our congressional districts are not competitive. So if you go to vote, you really know who's going to win which party long before you even see the names of the candidates. Is this an issue that your group tracks at all?
It is. Actually, we've done a whole lot of work on the issue that we have a somewhat different take on it than a lot of people. We sort of early on in our history raised we're 15-year history this year. Actually, I'll just mention we're having a big conference for anyone who's listening on the web or anyone from Illinois who would love to zip over. We have a Claim Democracy conference this weekend, claimdemocracy.com, a huge number of organizations, and this is one of the topics being debated among many others.
And let me add, I've been involved looking at the website. This is an extraordinary and really in many ways historic conference.
Yeah, well, thank you. And someday we'll move into the Free Press territory of your conferences. We do have Josh Silver from Free Press there, and hope to actually be involved in the next Free Press conference with some of the same people. That's one of the planning groups we hope comes out of this affair. So that's going on, and we're having our 15th anniversary dinner. That's going on in D.C., so claimdemocracy.com. We see the problem of redistricting as severe and serious, but we also see the problem of voter choice and lopsided districts being much more profoundly intrinsic to using winner-take-all elections. So that the idea that in many countries voters choose their representatives, that's really only true if you have a proportional voting method, because that's where, you know, 6% of the vote wins 6% of the seats and 28% of the vote wins 28% of the seats. There's a lot of different variations of proportional systems, but that's where you actually really do choose. If you have a fair system of drawing districts, you still end up having a very limited choice, and also usually most of the districts aren't close because we just don't naturally have 50-50 areas. And so we want to see independent redistricting. We don't think, you know, people should be able to help their friends and hurt their enemies in what should be a public interest process. But we also say don't stop there, or even don't even think it's going to really address the voter choice scandal.
So if we take care of the other stuff, gerrymandering will probably be worked out. It could be solved.
Well, yeah. I mean, so Illinois actually had 3-seat legislative districts for a state legislature up until 1980. It used one of the, not the most exciting proportional voting system, but cumulative voting, a system where almost all of those districts had a 2-1 split between the major parties, because it took about 25% of the vote to win one of the 3 seats. And that alone, you know, changed choice and opportunities for representation for people in a whole different kind of way. Basically, it allows a state to show its different shades of purple rather than, you know, just red or blue.
You know, could you back up a second, Rob Ritchie,
sure,
and explain this notion of cumulative voting? We've discussed it on the show before, and it's something people aren't really familiar with, even in Illinois.
Yeah, and it's a simple idea. It actually was put in after the Civil War in 1870. Joseph Medill and others sort of recognized the state was very divided in the Civil War era, and they didn't want to have the southern part of the state only by sort of Confederate-leaning representatives and the northern part of the state with union supporters, because those were the majorities in those areas, but a system that allowed a representation of more people. So what they did was put in a system where you had 3 representatives in a district, and that can be, by the way, a winner-take-all system, so that alone doesn't create a fairer system. But then they allowed
the House of Representatives.
State House of Reps.
State House, okay.
State House. And they used it up until 1980. It was a system there for a long time. And you could vote for one, sort of the most simple way to describe it is you could vote for 1, 2, or 3 people. And if you voted for 3, they each got 1. If you voted for 1, that person got your 3 votes. And if you voted for 2, they split your 3 votes. Mm-hmm. And so if your party, sort of like-minded voters, are about 30%, 25% in a district, and you give all your votes to one candidate, that actually can control, that candidate can win one of the 3 seats no matter what the rest of the voters do, and the majority can control 2 seats. So what the parties typically did was they each ran 2 candidates, and so knowing that unless it was a really lopsided district, they were very unlikely to win 3, and then they sort of fight it out, and they use the same system in the primary, where you'd vote for either 1 or 2 people, and so you'd get kind of 2 different kinds of people nominated by the party. So you'd end up with 3 sort of different segments of a district represented in a kind of a really different mix in Springfield, and very easy to do, and made gerrymandering and redistricting a lot less important. It early on created access for African Americans and in kind of white majority districts in a very natural way, and that's why Lonnie Guinier, the civil rights professor who was had her moment of controversy during the Clinton years, you know, she was a strong advocate of cumulative voting for what it did for providing fair racial representation, but it also really takes on some of these issues of voter choice.
Our guest today has been Rob Ritchie, the executive director of Fair Vote. Rob, we've got just a few seconds left. Perhaps you could tell listeners who want to learn more about this issue, follow up on it, get involved, what they can do.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on the show. We have a good website, fairvote.org. We are a nonprofit, so people can give donations, and that's always great. But we also are involved with a lot of people working on these issues in the states, and we can connect you with people who work on these issues. And there's a terrific, remarkable community of organizations that are working on the full set of things, many of which we didn't even talk about today, that are part of the Claim Democracy Conference. And one of my hopes with that conference is that we can make it a lot easier for someone to say, I want to get involved in electoral reform and whatever it might be, and make it really easy to match you with people who are doing good work on it.
Well, thanks
so stay
much.
In touch with us on that.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rob Ritchie, for joining us today. My name is Bob McChesney. Thank you all for joining us in Media Matters. Thank you, Andrew Boyle, for being our producer. Be back in 167 hours with Tariq Ali. Until then, have a good week.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.